Curtis Lewa.
Their own organization called the Guardian Angels. You see them with red berets.
I admire Curtis Lewa, and I think that he takes his life into his own hands doing what he does.
Curtis Lewa, the Guardian Angels founder and leader.
We've got Curtis Lewa from WABC Radio.
Curtis Lewa, legendary New York.
Drive at 5 with Curtis Lewa. What happened today? Why? And what's next? Live, local, on it. 77 WABC.
To get down, I'm not internationally known, but I'm known to rock the microphone because I get stupid. I mean, not
7 minutes after the hour of 5. Yours truly, Curtis Lewa, taking you home once again on the drive home at 5 on International Women's Day as we are high atop Madison Square Garden. These great facilities provided to us in order to do this broadcast to all of you by NJDiet.com. It takes two to tango, right? Well, an update, Cyrus White Shoes Vance continues to protect his predatorial friend, Harvey Weinstein, because you heard the chief of detectives for the New York City Police Department announce, we got all the goods we need to bag and tag Harvey Weinstein.
We have an actual case here. So we are happy with where the investigation is right now. Mr. Weinstein is in, out of state. We would need a arrest warrant to arrest him. So right now we're gathering our evidence.
Ah, and all they're waiting for is Cyrus White Shoes Vance, whose only comment on International Women's Day, what a perfect day it would have been to take Harvey Weinstein out in chains and shackles. No comment, because here's a guy who was wine-dined and pocket-lined by many of Harvey's phalanx of attorneys to the tune of $45,000 for a race in which he had no competition. Nobody ran against him. And then on the second legal note, wartime consigliere of Andrew Evil Eyes Cuomo, King Cuomo II, the son of Mario Faccia Bruta Cuomo, King Cuomo I, Joe Pococo, the jury has still not come to a conclusion in that trial, which, if you remember, before the snow, the sleet, and the cyclone bomb, thunder snow hit, was almost deadlocked, almost totally in deadlock. But while all this was transpiring, Comrade Bill de Blasio, the part-time mayor, the dope from Park Slope, engaged members of Room 9 down at City Hall, where all the paparazzi and the journalists lay up waiting for the news of the day. And he decided to go on a rant about how his wife, his very dear Kumbadichich, needs to be compensated for all of her hard work.
I just think it's a backwards notion. I would ask people to pay attention to the calendar. It's 2018. I said from the beginning, this is a partnership. I said from the beginning, she's going to be my number one advisor. She can't be paid. That's just not the way it's allowed under our law. She is consistently working on behalf of the city, on Thrive NYC, on the Mayor's Fund, on a whole host of issues. Mm-hmm. And I involve her in this interview process, and she contributes a whole lot. She spent many hours over this last weekend working with me and with Dean Fulahan on this. I think people should say that's great.
Who asked you, right? Who asked you to bring her on board, huh? And then he went on to make the pitch about how his wife, Shirlane, should be funded by us to suck at taxpayers.
I don't understand it, because if someone's working full-time and is a professional with a lot of background and applying themselves, I understand why they can't get paid, but she can't get paid. So she's doing it volunteer, but she's doing it 110%.
A real Mother Teresa. Huh. Selfless service at its finest. On the line to discuss that, Michael Benjamin, New York Post editorial board member and op-ed columnist. Thanks for joining us again on the Drive Home at 5. Mike?
My pleasure, Curtis. Thank you.
All right, so what do you make of this pitch by the mayor to suggest to all of us taxpayers out there that we fund the efforts of his wife to act as his consigliere?
Well, the mayor is feeling stung by a recent news release that had he and his wife co-appointing their new deputy mayor. And when they realized the error, they said they corrected it to say that they were announcing together. But the mayor has given his wife a great deal of authority, apparently, within his administration to help him with the vetting of staff, of coming up with policies. And now because we've noticed him, we're talking about it, here he's now saying, well, you know, she ought to be paid for what she does. Well, she doesn't have to be. She doesn't have to be involved at all. But that's his choice to involve her and her choice to do it unpaid. And, you know, the anti-nepotism laws were put in place by progressives like him to prevent politicians and others from, you know, putting their family and friends on the public payroll.
How?
For no work. I mean, that's the very thing that Joe Prococo was on trial for his wife getting, well, while it wasn't a public payroll, his wife allegedly was getting a low-show job so that he could be influenced to work on their behalf within the Cuomo administration.
Yeah, I love that term that's come out of the Prococo trial, a low-show job, as opposed to a no-show job that we heard about when Dean the Greek Skelos was getting his special ed son, Adam, a no-show job.
Yes. But, I think that did qualify as a low-show job.
Well, explain exactly what the mayor's wife does and how it may actually be harmful to the process of government in New York City.
Well, I don't think what she does is harmful. I think what's harmful is the mayor insisting that she ought to be paid. I mean, what's been harmful is that some of the commissioners that we're actually paying for have done lousy jobs for on behalf of the taxpayers and citizens and residents of New York City. Is she more concerned about their work than concerned about the work his wife is doing for free for him and his administration? Yes, she is leading the effort around New York City Thrive, an effort around calling attention to mental health initiatives and trying to get more New Yorkers to avoid the stigma of mental health and trying to get treatment and doing those sort of things and trying to raise money for a variety of projects in New York, as most first ladies have done. But she's taken a very public role in going beyond just that, in helping him to vet his police commissioner, his schools chancellor, and all his top appointees, even deputy mayors, and sitting with him in the kitchen or in Gracie Mansion or at City Hall to interview the candidates and then to collaborate on determining who ought to be in place.
Now, Michael, unlike a lot of journalists or commentators, you've actually been involved in the political process. You were an assemblyman up in Albany representing the Bronx. You've been part of campaigns. Let's just hypothetically think of you as a deputy mayor was having a honest one-on-one conversation with the mayor in which you disagreed with bringing Carranza on board, who's just become our new school's chancellor, and the mayor's wife was lobbying for him. How difficult would that be for you to have that kind of conversation with the mayor while his wife is right in the same room and you clearly see that you're taking an adversarial tone towards her suggestion?
Oh, hopefully you would hope that the mayor has sees everybody equally, and whatever weight he gives to his wife's support and suggestions is up to him. But if you're there as a staff person, you're giving him your best advice, and it shouldn't matter whether she's in the room. I would not be intimidated by the fact his wife is there. He'll then take what I have to say and what he has to say, and then he'll determine what's best. If he chooses to go with his wife's advice, no, it's on him. I've done my job.
Yeah, but imagine he's riding home with his wife to Gracie Mansion. He'll have to get an earful if he sides with you, Michael Benjamin, against the wishes of his wife.
Again, that's not my concern. And as a staff person, I wasn't elected. He's elected to make big decisions. The buck stops with him. And if he chooses to have it to discuss the buck stopping with his spouse, his partner, as he says she is in politics and in life, then that's on him. It's not really on a staff person. What New Yorkers should be concerned about is whether or not they're using a platform of the First Lady of New York City, what they call Flow Nights, as a platform for her to run for a public office, whether it be Borough President of Brooklyn or even a public ask of the City of New York in 2021.
And, Michael, what do you make of this ongoing beef back and forth between the governor and the mayor? It's really reached a point where it's almost like Abbott and Costello, Laurel and Hardy. It's like one says one thing and the other fires back.
Yeah, it's like that, and it's also on the governor's part of it, somewhat mean girlish, because he's always seeming to do things that trying to get under the skin of the mayor, with undercutting his authority as the mayor of the City of New York. And at the end of the day, it really hurts New York City residents. We have a governor who constantly does this sort of thing. Instead of trying to be a partner with the mayor or the other elected officials in our city, because it just distracts from and delays getting anything done for New York City.
Do you think that's why we've heard that Cynthia Nixon may be primarying the governor? Because this is obviously a very dear friend of de Blasio. This would be a tremendous sense of payback, wouldn't it?
No, for those who believe that, it could be, considering 4 years ago the mayor went out on a limb to secure for the governor the working party's nomination. And then we believe that, you know, the governor sort of stabbed the mayor in the back and the working party folks in the back, and they're all ticked off. And, you know, in politics, you know, revenge happens. It's part of the course. And I think the governor's right. You know, he's wearing his big boy pants, and he can deal with it.
Do appreciate that. That's Michael Benjamin, New York Post editorial board contributor and op-ed columnist. As, your mayor, Comrade Bill de Blasio, because I didn't elect him, not the first time, nor the second time. The part-time mayor, the dope from Park Slope, now suggests that you and me, the sucker taxpayers, pay his wife, who already has five staff members, and her chief of staff makes $220,000. For what? Growing barnacles on her backside?
Curtis Lewa.
Really trying to help our cause.
The Drive at 5.
We're very honored to have him here today.
77 WABC.
Sounds like the music to Mortal Kombat, one of the many violent video games out there, like Resident Evil or Fortnite or Killing Floor, Left 4 Dead, Doom, Call of Duty, Grand Theft Auto, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. There'll probably be more. But the President of the United States trying to come up with an answer for why we have the kind of violence we've had of late, particularly when one person off the hook decides to get an assault weapon and shoot up a school or mall or park or whatever, has suggested that it's due to young people watching violent video games.
We have to do something about maybe what they're seeing and how they're seeing it, and also video games. I'm hearing more and more people say the level of violence on video games is really shaping young people's thoughts.
And so he sat down with the CEOs of most of the major companies in that field. And on the line to discuss it is Chris Ferguson, professor of psychology at Stetson University. Thanks for joining us, Chris, here on the Drive Home at 5.
It's great to be on. Thanks for having me.
All right, Chris. So here was the president today. He had most of the major CEOs and those who manage these video companies, a lot of them that churn out these violent videos. Any truth to what the president believes, that they have contributed to the madness that we have seen of late?
Yeah, basically the short answer is no. In fact, the scientific evidence at this point is pretty clear that, you know, of course, a lot of video games are made for adults. They contain content that is offensive to a lot of people, and there's no doubt about that. But in terms of evidence that they actually contribute to societal violence, from a number of different sources we have now, the evidence really is pretty clear that there's nothing to this. You know, we do a lot of studies looking at youth violence at Stetson University and, you know, tracking kids over time, and we find no evidence that, you know, violent video game playing contributes to bullying or dating violence or adult arrest. The evidence we have on mass shooters suggests that mass shooters, if anything, consume less violent video games than the average person does. Cross-national comparisons, the countries that compare watch more violent video games than the United States do per capita, or like the Netherlands and South Korea, have some of the lowest violent crime rates. But it really doesn't matter like what pool of data you look at; it all kind of converges on the same thing, that this is really a dead end. This is really not something that's going to be a very helpful conversation if we're really serious in reducing gun violence in our country.
So just for the purpose of informing our many listeners out there, you're saying that based on what you've researched in terms of some of the more egregious shootings that have taken place in the last few years, the shooters responsible for that, how do they match up to the average viewers of violent video games in comparison to average everyday folks who don't go off the hook?
Yeah. So with video game playing, we do tend to find that, you know, most mass shooters, like I said, you know, tend to consume less than average violent video games. And some of the issue is actually there's a misperception of some of the shooters. So for instance, like the Virginia Tech shooter turned out mostly played Sonic the Hedgehog, which is a very innocuous, nonviolent video game. And even the Sandy Hook shooter, he probably played both some violent and nonviolent games, but he mostly played Dance Dance Revolution, which is, again, a very innocuous, nonviolent, video game. So, and of course, the average age of a mass homicide perpetrator is actually closer to 40. So we tend to pay attention to video games only when a shooter is a young male, like the Parkland shooter just recently, and ignore it if the shooter is an older male, like the Las Vegas shooter back in October. And that creates kind of a false sense of there being a correlation where, in fact, none exists. I mean, the commonalities that we see among mass homicide perpetrators have nothing to do with entertainment media and have everything to do with having a long history of antisocial personality issues and antisocial behavior. They have been invariably have problems with mental illness and tend to be what we call injustice collectors. And they blame other people for their problems and want to take that out on those other individuals.
I know, but a person with a violent streak in them, and they see this violence portrayed over and over and over in the form of a violent video game. For instance, like Grand Theft Auto, there's so many of them. I'm sure they're in production for numbers 9, 10, 11, 12, and more.
Sure.
Don't you think that they not only live vicariously through that, but some people actually say, man, I want to go out and live the life. I want to keep it real.
Yeah. We don't find any evidence for a copycat kind of effect from games. In fact, there have been a couple of studies. A colleague of mine, Ray Surratt at University of Central Florida, has actually done a few studies looking at people who've been incarcerated for violent crimes and things like that. And he's looked at those populations and has not found any evidence that incarcerated populations of violent criminals having played any more violent video games or watched any more violent television than anybody else. So I think it's one of these ideas that it seems to sort of make sense to people, but or at least to a certain group of people. But the evidence doesn't really support it. In fact, there's some evidence that suggests that for people who enjoy violent video games, it actually relaxes them and calms them down. And it's kind of the same thing we're seeing with some of the recent research on heavy metal music. In fact, which has also oftentimes been kind of demonized as causing everything from suicide to Satanism, is that for people who enjoy the heavy metal music, it actually tends to calm them down and relax them. What we tend to have is an issue with a certain segment of the population, mostly older adults who don't play video games or don't listen to heavy metal. They see these things, they're offended by them, and they just think it's common sense that because they find this stuff to be offensive, it must also be harmful.
Chris, this is interesting, claiming it's almost like a form of mental Prozac, watching the violent video game or listening to heavy metal music. I've listened to a lot of AC/DC, Shoot for Thrills. Crank it up here, Brian. Let me see if it calms me down. Every day I make a list up in my head of all the people I want to kill. And boy, if only they could drop dead and breathe. Or meet some kind of a accident. Oh, it would make me feel so good. It would be like mental Prozac for me.
Primus in the Morning.
So far, so good.
And the Drive at 5.
There are so many ways to do it.
On air, online, on the app.
That's unbelievable.
77 WABC.
You talk too much.
You never shut up.
I said you talk too much.
Oh boy, you never shut up.
I'm 41, and this may be true of Donald Trump, our president, when it comes to his involvement with Mueller's investigation, his special counsel, along with his inquisitors. It's a New York Times report indicating that he may have sort of skirted the issue in terms of his involvement in witness tampering. Now, it's a complicated issue, so we've invited on to discuss it Randy Barnett of Georgetown, a Georgetown law professor. Thanks for joining us here on the Drive Home at 5, Randy.
It's great to be here, Curtis.
Okay, so let's look at the White House counsel, McCann. Supposedly, he had a conversation with him that involved what, if you could explain?
Well, actually, I'm not. I try to avoid some of the details of this stuff. I don't follow every twist and turn that we're supposed to be all excited about every single day. I just was happy to talk to you about what's okay and what's not okay when people are talking to witnesses in an investigation. I used to be a prosecutor in Chicago, and I have some familiarity with people talking to each other.
Okay, well, let me take you back, remember, to Whitewater. And the president's personal secretary at that time, Betty Curry, was called in by Judge Starr to a grand jury, I think, three times. And Bill Clinton had a sit-down with her in his office in which he said, Betty, if you don't mind, I'd like a few minutes with you. I want to nourish your memory about some of the things that were involved in conversations with Monica Lewinsky. Would that sort of fit into the realm of potential witness tampering?
I don't think so. Look, witness tampering is a very specific thing. It's when you're trying to deter or coerce a witness to testify untruthfully in any, you know, by any other means. It's not witness tampering to talk to a witness. The president can talk to his subordinates. The president can talk to anybody. A witness can talk to anybody. Prosecutors don't like it. They don't like it one bit. But they don't have the power to silence you so that you don't talk to anybody. Now, the risk the reason why lawyers advise people not to do it is because there's a risk you'll then be accused of trying to intimidate or coerce or otherwise influence a witness to testify falsely. And if you don't ever talk to anybody, you can say, well, I didn't talk. You can deny talking to him at all. But if you do talk to him, there's no reason why you can't talk to them about anything you want.
So asking someone maybe who appeared before a grand jury that was investigating your presidency and asking him, hey, how did it go? And knowing he might be called back again would not constitute interference at any point. You would have a right.
I would think it's freedom of speech. And anybody can talk to anybody about that. And there's just no bar to that.
You know, would you be able to actually go into elements of what your testimony were?
Sure. Why not? I mean, it's what you're not allowed to do is coerce, intimidate, attempt to get somebody to perjure themselves, to lie. You can't do any of those things. But why can't you talk to other witnesses about whatever you're going to talk about? I mean, say you're a victim of a crime and you have a family member and you all were the victim of the same crime. You can't talk to the other family members about what they saw and when they saw it?
So there's never an instruction, like if you're summoned to appear to give evidence to a grand jury, that once you leave that courtroom, once you're dismissed, you're not to discuss that with anyone?
Well, there a party to the court can be under some confidentiality obligations. A party to a lawsuit can be. But I don't see where the obligation would be. You might, and maybe you might not be able to disclose what happens in a grand jury, but you can certainly talk about other matters that are related to the case.
Now, in the story, it indicated that Priebus, who had previously been President Donald Trump's chief of staff, had let his own personal attorney know, and that personal attorney alerted Mueller's staff that the president had a conversation with him, which was, hey, I hope they treated you okay. There was really, according to you, no need for that communication to take place.
Oh, well, it's entirely possible that Priebus is trying to protect himself from charges, that he may have changed his story, or that, you know, and if he's trying to fully cooperate in order to avoid any sanctions falling on him, he may want to tell the special counsel whatever anything that might happen in the future. And that's another reason why it's probably not a good idea for the president to talk to these people, because of what they're likely to turn around and say about him. But it's not a question. But the discussion itself is not something that he's responsible for. Now, you know, one of the things that they talk about a lot is obstruction of justice. And it is not obstruction of justice to talk to a witness. That's not obstruction of justice.
Now, with the two grand juries who are impaneled here, and Mueller's investigators obviously calling in a number of people to testify before him, and we really don't hear about it until after the fact, how long could you see this process going before the grand jury comes back with some kind of bill of goods?
I have no idea. Nobody has any idea. These things seem to take forever. It's one argument against ever having a special counsel, because once you have one, then you've got a perpetual investigation of everything. But I have no idea, and I don't. Nobody except the Mueller people know how long this is going to take them.
Now, in normal criminal prosecutions, when it gets to a grand jury phase, oftentimes grand jurors are hearing multiple cases at the same time. You know, they may take a 2-day rest from one case. They're hearing another case simultaneously. Because of the special nature of this situation with the special prosecutor having been given the responsibility to see if there was any collusion between the Russians and the Trump campaign, is this grand jury just exclusively hearing Mueller's testimony?
I honestly don't know, Curtis. There are two kinds of grand juries. There are specially impaneled grand juries that hear the same case and they sit for a very long time. And then there's the regular grand jury that usually sits for something like a month at a time.
Hmm.
And so I honestly don't know which kind it is. It should be a matter of public record which kind it is. But it sounds to me like it would be a special grand jury impaneled to continually hear this matter.
Well, do appreciate it. Randy Barnett, Georgetown law professor, gave us a lot of clarity there because I was certainly confused. I was under the impression that once a person appears before a grand jury, that you are not to have had a conversation, particularly if you're the potential object or the subject of the grand jury's investigation, where you're having a conversation with that person about what their testimony might have been or the direction that the grand jury was going. You see, I learned something today. The question is, did you?
The Drive at 5.
Curtis Sliwa.
On the air, on the app. Curtis Sliwa, live.
My boy Curtis Sliwa.
Local.
There's a guy in a red hat.
On it.
Everybody listens to Curtis.
77 WABC.
Hand me down. That's the bank. Now you're pumped. You got to get ready for the big payback.
Hey, hipster millennial, what was that announcement I heard Sid Rosenberg do just moments ago?
Bernie and Sid here. Hey, everybody, join us weekday morning starting Monday, April the 2nd.
Fantastic guests, laughs, mischief, and so much more.
It's only right here, folks, on 77 WABC.
What a traditor. What a Judas. That meant that Bernard McGurk and Sid Rosenberg will be doing the morning show when Imus retires from 6 to 10, Monday through Fridays, right? Do you know I put in a pitch for that? Curtis and my many exes, right? You'd have one ex each morning. It'd be Corinne, my first wife, on Monday, Lisa on Tuesday, Mary on Wednesday, Melinda on Thursday, and my latest home slice, right? Nancy Regula, hopefully won't be my ex on Friday, right? And it wouldn't have cost the station anything. And forget weather with Bill Evans. I would have walked to the window and told you what the weather was. And then there would have been the Curtis Lee with Super Sports Spectacular. And I would have done Mob Talk to Geriatric Espresso, sipping psychotic killers of organized crime, giving you updates. And there would have been a Wee Be Thuggin' update about the Uzi toting dope-sucking psychopathic killing machines. But oh, no. Management went with Bernard McGurk and Sid Rosenberg. You are my enemies now. You have stuck the shiv in my back. It should have been Curtis and his exes in the morning, then Curtis and Rita in the afternoon, and then Curtis on your drive home at 5. I should have scored the trifecta, the trinity, the troika here at WABC. This is a shanda.